Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news recap from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, an advisory council for the Bears Ears National Monument lacks any monument supporters. Environmental activists shut down a Utah Inland Port Authority board meeting. And Moab's tourism boom reaches a tipping point. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley here in studio. And Brian, welcome to you. Good morning.
Good morning, Roger. It's good to be here.
Thanks for being here. Also, thanks to Taylor Stevens, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. Thanks to you, and good morning.
Good morning.
And we've got George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. George Pyle, welcome to you.
Good morning.
We invite you to join this conversation. Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can tweet questions and comments to us. We are at KCPW or post them at sltrib.com. Brian Maffley, let's start with some news related to national monuments in Utah. The Department of the Interior this week released a list of members of an advisory committee for the Bears Ears National Monument. And actually, Brian, just so we're not confused, this committee is meant to advise on the management of the original monument or of the downsized monument, because they are they're not the same thing, right?
This is for the downsized monument, which is roughly 200,000 acres versus the nearly 1.5 million, 1.3 million in the original designation that Obama did in 2016.
And this is, the reason there was a downsizing done by the Trump administration, the fact that's being challenged in the courts, right?
Of course.
Shrinking of the monuments.
That's right.
Okay. So just to continue on that theme for a second, can this committee that has been unveiled, can it do very much in the interim while we wait for that court case to go?
Well, they can have an important role in deciding how the monument management plan will be crafted. That's underway right now. To back up a little bit, this advisory committee was first envisioned in the Barack Obama proclamation 2.5 years ago. So here we have, we're 2.5 years later and we finally have an advisory committee. So the fact was, for that first year after President Trump was elected, no progress was made on forming this committee. And of course, the monument was in flux this whole time. And so what they did was, after Trump issued his proclamation downsizing the monument, they did follow through with forming the committee.
Okay.
Several people applied for spots on the committee. There's many spots. They're reserved for specific interest groups, organized developed recreation, conservation, the county government, things of that sort.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, let's turn to this committee and who's, actually on it. There's been criticism of it. Who is in? Who's out? Why is there criticism?
Well, the monument supporters are deeply unhappy that there are no pro-monument activists on this committee, while it seems to be stacked with people who either oppose the monument or actively campaigned against it. So, someone like Jamie Bayless, let's talk about her. She's the founder of a group called Stewards of San Juan, and she campaigned against the monument and then applauded its reduction. And of course, Jamie Bayless deserves to be on that advisory committee. She's extremely involved in the issues. She lives in Blanding, and yet there's no one to balance her voice on the committee. One of the criticisms was, here you have a group that includes a lot of people who believe the monument shouldn't even exist. Right. And so now you have these folks offering advice on how to manage it. And so it seems that the criticism here is that you ought to have people on that committee who participated in crafting the proposal. And certainly a lot of those people did apply and they were looked over.
Yeah. There's a quote here from Josh Ewing, executive director of the Friends of Cedar Mesa, which is a conservation group. In your article, he says that these appointments mean that, quote, the BLM and the Forest Service are asking people who don't think the monument should exist for advice on how to manage it.
Yeah.
And then, as you pointed out, the woman who you just mentioned, is she has a grazing allotment inside of the...
That's Gail Johnson. Yeah.
Oh, that's Gail Johnson.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, of course, she should be on Gail should be on the advisory committee, too, because there's a spot reserved for allotment holder, and she's definitely one.
Did this come at all as a surprise? I mean, it's the Interior Department's decision.
Yeah.
Interior leadership is appointed by the Trump administration.
I'm surprised. I would have thought that they would have tried to at least... give at least some token representation for pro-monument people. Their choice for the county elected leader was really telling. They chose Bruce Adams, who's a stalwart anti-monument voice, as were all the county commissioners were at the time of the designation. Since then, the county commission has flipped, and you have two pro-monument activists who serve on the county commission. So there's a majority Native American pro-monument county commission. These are Willie Gray Eyes and Kenneth Maryboy. Well, neither of them were selected. Although, arguably, they're more representative of the wishes of the county.
Well, there's that, and then there's also another point of criticism around who got appointed to this committee is that there isn't a lot in the way of tribal representation in general, despite the fact that there was a coalition of tribes that created the original proposal.
To be fair to the Department of Interior, there is a sister committee called the Bears Ears Commission, now Shasjaw Commission, was renamed because of the Trump proclamation, renaming the Bears Ears unit of the monument Shasjaw, which is the Navajo term for Bears Ears. That commission formed immediately after the original designation, and each of the five tribes named a member to the commission. That commission had met regularly for the first year and almost had almost no engagement with the Department of Interior. They were trying to offer some guidance and advice. It was basically ignored from if you ask the Bears Ears Commission, and they really object to being renamed Shasjaw. That to them is an insult because it highlights a single tribe's interest in that region, the Navajo, by choosing their name for the unit, whereas Bears Ears is something all five tribes can agree on. That kind of encompasses all five. And that's one of the beauties, strong points of the monument. It was kind of a unifying principle for five tribes that historically don't get along. Well, here's an issue they do get along on, this large monument deserves to stay in place. They proposed it, and Bama followed through, although he designated a much smaller monument than they proposed, still a big one. And so the Bears Ears Commission's kind of gone silent since the Trump proclamation shrinking the monument. I think they don't even want to dignify Trump's action. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, by them continuing to meet would kind of legitimize it. So there really isn't a whole lot of tribal representation anymore.
Is there, we talked about the court case that was mentioned over that original Bears Ears proclamation. That is challenging the downsizing of this monument. A couple of court challenges, actually. There's one over Bears Ears, one over Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Are those still in progress, Brian? Are there any updates on what's happening there?
They seem to be kind of going through the courts pretty slowly. It was only recently that the federal judge in D.C., declined to move them to Utah. The state, the supporters of the Trump action, i.e., anti-monument concerns, wanted the lawsuits transferred to Utah. The judge said no, and now she is weighing a number of other motions, mostly groups that are seeking to intervene in the lawsuit, which includes San Juan County. They had filed. San Juan County, of course, the county where the monument is, they had originally filed papers to intervene on behalf of the Trump administration, basically siding with them. The county now has reversed positions and have withdrawn that. Mm-hmm. But there's sportsmen's groups. There's also the state. There's numerous groups seeking to intervene in the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to the committee for a minute here, and the and who's on this committee. The you know, in terms of what actually happens in a monument, the kinds of activities allowed, how things like wildlife and cultural and historical or historical resources are taken care of. These committees are pretty powerful in determining how a monument operates on a day-to-day basis. Is that correct?
I think so. The guidance they offer for the other the Grand Staircase, I think it is taken seriously. They don't make decisions. The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, makes decisions, but they take a lot of cues from these advisory committees. So it's formally known as the Monument Advisory Committee. There's also a similar committee for the entire state called the Resource Advisory Council or Committee, RAC as the acronym for it, that meets once or twice a year. And I feel they play an important role in terms of providing the federal agencies input from local stakeholders. And they kind of take, they might not do everything these local stakeholders want, but at least it has some kind of influence.
I wanted to bring let me remind listeners that they can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Actually, Brian, we were talking about Bears Ears National Monument. There's also the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, the other one that President Trump downsized.
Yeah.
Did that downsizing mean new appointments to an advisory committee for that committee, in that we're seeing a new monument out of the old monument? Does that mean a new advisory committee that one as well?
I think there's not a new advisory committee, but there are new members on it. But that's just kind of normal turnover year. The terms last for 4 years, and so you kind of have not many people serve more than one term, so there's just the kind of normal turnover. So, and the terms are staggered, so every year you'll get some turnover. So that's what's going on at the Grand Staircase Advisory Committee. And both these committees for Bears Ears and Grand Staircase will be meeting in the very, very near future.
Okay. Yeah. I want to bring George Pyle, editorial voice in the room, in on this conversation. And again, George, this is the Trump administration. Should we have expected something different on public lands coming out of this Interior Department? And your thoughts more generally on the makeup of this committee for the Bears Ears National Monument, the Shasha, the downsized Bears Ears National Monument.
Well, what they've done is basically this is as if you appointed a committee to rebuild Notre Dame Cathedral and you didn't put any Catholics on it. The monument, big or small, exists because the Native American tribes wanted it to exist, and they didn't want it to exist just as a tourist destination or a cash cow or something like that. They wanted it to exist basically as a historic, religious, spiritual, I don't want to say relic, but that place that was important, and they wanted it protected. Now, whoever's president and however big the monument is, national monuments are land that was already owned by the federal government, that was already under the control of the BLM or the Forest Service or somebody. So the details of how it's managed day to day is where the details come out, and where the way people actually will live there and visit there and worship there, how that happens. And that was part of the problem with like Obama waiting until the 11th hour to designate this monument and to start the process of having a committee, which in his case would be much more represented from the five tribes, and get them together, as Brian says, a group of people who don't always agree on much. This was something they could agree on, work together on, which in itself is progress. And now it's just kind of like a kick in the teeth to say, not only have we downsized your monument, but we've done another thing to take it away from the people who got it going in the first place. Even after the county commission flipped in San Juan County, they used to say the people in San Juan County aren't for this. Now the people in San Juan County, through their elected representatives, are for this, and they should honor that.
George Pyle again, a columnist with Salt Lake Tribune, and his editorial voice there. Brian, the wild card here, I mean, George is talking about that last hour declaration of the National Monument by President Obama. In some ways, the wild card here was the election of President Trump, which was, you imagine that President Obama making this declaration didn't expect that he would be followed by President Trump in office.
Well, I don't know if anybody expected that.
Sure, good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything we're missing on the story? I mean, people were who applied to be part of this commission and
we don't. The Interior Department has not been particularly transparent. Initially, they wouldn't even tell me exactly how many people applied. We've since learned that it was 58 for the 15 spots, and two of the spots were reserved for quote unquote tribal concerns. And the only two Native Americans named to the committee were pigeonholed into that slot. Well, Native Americans had been applied for many of those positions, including Malcolm Lehi, who's a former Ute Mountain Ute tribal official and a rancher. We know that Willie Gray Eyes, the county commissioner, was Jonah Yellowman, who was the kind of a spiritual advisor to the Utah Dene Bakea organization, and they had received an endorsement from Rupert Steele, who's the chairman of the Utah Tribal Leaders Association. So the two Native Americans who were selected to serve on the committee both come from the Aneth chapter of the Navajo tribe, which was the one Utah chapter that opposes the monument. The rest of the chapters, there's six others, all passed some sort of resolution endorsing the monument. And so they turned to the one community and the one of the one tribe to find tribal representation. Well, there are four other tribes involved, and there's six other chapter houses. So it just seemed like it was rigged according to the critics. It just seemed rigged to wind up with anti-monument slant.
When will they have their first meeting?
Haven't said it yet, but it'll be soon.
Okay. Brian Maffley, thank you very much for your reporting on this. It is time for our first break on the show. Still to come, protesters shut down an Inland Port Authority board meeting and the challenges presented by Moab's tourism boom. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Taylor Stevens and columnist George Pyle. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Post them to the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com, or you can tweet us. We are at KCPW. Let's turn now to Tribune coverage of a meeting of the Utah Inland Port Authority Board. Reporter Taylor Stevens was there, and Taylor, it was a meeting that was disrupted by protesters, and they actually shut it down entirely, right? They shut this meeting down so that it couldn't happen.
Yeah, so this meeting was held at North Star Elementary School, kind of in the west side area of Salt Lake City. And less than five minutes into the start of the meeting, I think they had just kind of approved the minutes. A protester stood up with a megaphone and announced that they were holding a protest there. For a few minutes, the board, and obviously the board was surprised to see this happen, and for a few minutes, the board kind of waited and watched, and then said they were taking a 15-minute break, and then a few minutes later, just started wrapping up cords and announced they were leaving entirely. So,
what was the protesters' sort of driving purpose for this action, or what was their message?
So their message is that they do not feel that the board overseeing development of this massive planned distribution hub in Salt Lake City's northwest side have been listening to the concerns of the people. So they say that they've come, they've spoken at public comment, they have participated in the public engagement process, and they feel that that process is kind of just for show, and that they are not really having meaningful dialogue about some of their concerns, which include air quality, you know, how is this development going to have impacts? I mean, this has been billed as the state's largest ever economic project. And so how is that going to impact air quality, traffic, wildlife in this Great Salt Lake area? And, you know, without feeling like they had a meaningful dialogue, they said they felt they had no other recourse but to take over the meeting.
These were members of an activist group called Civil Riot. Do you know much about how the group came to be or where they're from?
No, not yet. We've been seeing them around quite a bit recently in Salt Lake City. They were also present at a housing justice rally on Tuesday night before the Salt Lake City Council meeting. So I think we have some research to do into them and see kind of where they're headed next. They've been around a lot.
You know, last week we talked about the mayor's race and the call by Mayor Jackie Biskupski for candidates for mayor and actually other elected officials to join her lawsuit or to support her lawsuit, I should say. This is a lawsuit over the port looking to undo its creation, the creation of the inland port or the state's takeover of land in Salt Lake City's jurisdiction, according to the mayor. Are there any updates on that lawsuit? And I know I sound like a broken record here because I asked you the same question last week, but have any candidates heeded that call, come out in favor of her lawsuit or alternatively come out against it?
Yeah, we were seeing this moving really slowly, again, through the court system. So we don't really have much of an update on that front. We do have a candidate, David Garbett, the former executive director of the Pioneer Park Coalition, as well as a staff attorney at the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance for a lot of years. He has taken a stronger position against the inland port. But barring that, we're seeing candidates, I think, kind of watch and wait and see. The race is still pretty young, although it's going to start heating up in the next few weeks and months as the August primary nears closer.
Sure. This board meeting of the Utah Inland Port Authority got shut down. What was going to happen at this meeting, Taylor?
Yeah, they had a bunch of agenda items that they were looking at, including an update on the wildlife habitat from the Audubon Society of Salt Lake, as well as an update on their executive director. They're still searching for an executive director. And so the interim executive director of the Inland Port, I caught him as kind of he walked out of the meeting, and he said he was disappointed in the tactics because there's a public comment period in which everyone has 2 minutes to kind of speak their piece, and that these protesters should have followed kind of the normal kind of standard operating procedures so that everyone could have had a chance to speak. Again, these protesters say that they've done that and don't feel that they've been listened to, so that's why they resorted to these tactics. But they, you know, really saw the fact that they shut down this meeting as a victory, and they're planning on coming to the next meeting and the next one and the next one, and I'm sure in future meetings we're going to see them escorted out. A little surprising, I think, that they weren't escorted out at this meeting, which is typical when someone doesn't follow rules of decorum in public meetings. But
Has this particular meeting been rescheduled, Taylor? And you said that protesters are going to show up there, but are we expecting this meeting anytime soon?
No, it hasn't been rescheduled yet. They've currently been holding a monthly meeting, but they haven't rescheduled this one yet.
Yeah, can I weigh in here?
Sure. Yeah, we got Brian Maffley.
Taylor, why is this group declining to just go through the regular legal challenges like through the courts or through the public process that all the other groups go through?
So this group is pretty young, a bunch of young people, and you know, they talk about kind of this west side as being underserved, as having fewer resources. And so I think that they feel maybe they don't have those resources, or that they're speaking for people who don't have those resources. There already is a legal challenge. But I think they also want to send a message that people oppose this project. The port board has said this is a small group of people. There's a group called Stop the Polluting Port that has been doing a lot of outreach, and I think that kind of the entry of Civil Riot into this conversation is a product of that. But I think they want to show, you know, it's not just Stop the Polluting Port, this core group of 20 people who have been involved since the beginning that's opposed to this. It's a bigger coalition.
Yeah.
George, George Pyle, editorial voice here on the program again, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Taylor brought up the idea of these protesters being escorted out of a future meeting or any future meetings because of rules of decorum. It's interesting because you have the mayor of Salt Lake City saying that this thing, the Inland Port, is illegitimate and was created through an unconstitutional act of the legislature. Meanwhile, the state is trying to conduct the business of setting up this project. Your thoughts on, you know, decorum or otherwise, George Pyle?
Well, you do have to have a level of decorum in public meetings because you can't just have, what do they call it, the censorship of the loudmouth. There's a better phrase for it than that. But
the tyranny of the majority, of the minority.
The tyranny of the minority or the heckler's veto. That's it. That's what I was looking at, the heckler's veto. It does kind of seem like the board was not ready for this, and now they will be ready for it. And I imagine there'll be some police officers or sheriff's deputies there or something to, in anticipation of this next round. It's kind of ironic that one of the things on the agenda was to hear from the Audubon Society, so and how the port might develop in a way that is less damaging to the wildlife and the wetlands and things like that. So they didn't even let the Audubon Society speak, which you would think maybe that's something that's really important. This comes down to the question of will this area, which is going to develop, I mean, there's no reason to think that it's going to look 20 years from now the way it looks today. So the argument for the Inland Port is that if there is this overarching body that has development oversight and tax increment power and all these kinds of things, that it might develop less horribly than it would if it just sort of filled in over time with no master plan.
And there is a master plan for this area,
but there is a master plan. And the other side of it is, why is this Port Authority even exist? The only reason that I can think of why this Port Authority exists is because the legislature was concerned that if this remained totally in the jurisdiction of the city, the gay-friendly, gender equity, adjunct faculty, Obama-voting city, that the bulldozers might be stayed and the place might not develop the way they want, and the real estate commissions to be made might not happen. So you kind of have two sides that believe something about the other side. Whether it's true or not, they believe it deeply. The anti-port people believe that the fix is in, that the only reason the Port Authority exists is to bulldoze not only the land but all environmental concerns. Yeah. The people in favor of the port believe, whether it's true or not, that the city would never do anything that would help them make all this money they see.
Well, and Taylor, this comes back to you brought up the master plan that the city has. I mean, that is the city's master plan. That just, I guess, wasn't to the liking of the legislature when it as the city says, usurped the land authority from Salt Lake City. Is that the fundamental difference?
Well, and some of this comes down to who gets the money, who gets the zoning authority. So when the Inland Port Authority Board took over this swath of land, they also took over the ability to make zoning decisions and to collect all of the tax differential tax increment from the area. And so not only is this about how does this area develop, it's also about who has the money and who gets to make the final decisions about what goes in. And so I think to George's point, the city kind of their stance is that although they had planned for this area to develop into something like an inland port, they would have put more of an impetus on making that environmentally sustainable, net zero buildings, whereas the state is going to, in their estimation, put the kind of largest emphasis on profit above all else. And so that's part of this as well, and as well as maybe some misunderstandings about what this area has always kind of been planned to be potentially.
Sure. The city also, I mean, we have talked on previous shows about the city conceivably wanting to limit the amount of natural resources passing through, and the state having probably an interest in getting those through. We're talking about coal, natural gas from Utah's land, waxy crude, for example.
Yeah.
Which would be a thing to bring Brian Maffley on, but we've probably got to move on to other stories because we have limited time here. And so activists shut down a meeting of this Inland Port Authority Board meeting. Let's turn to another story, Taylor, where You reported that that also included some activism at the local level. This is in advance of a Salt Lake City Council meeting and included apparently some of the same members of this group. And then to the meeting itself, this is the topic here was affordable housing, the need for or the lack of affordable housing in the Salt Lake City area. Maybe we can start with the action in advance of the meeting. Who was there and what were they trying to accomplish? Taylor.
So again, some protesters from Civil Riot, as well as some other organizations, Utah Against Police Brutality was present. But, you know, some young activist groups that are concerned about a lack of affordable housing, as you said, and its connections to homelessness, as well as to housing insecurity. So, you know, having a situation where your finances are such that any kind of emergency might, you know, set you into a path to homelessness because your rent is so expensive compared to what you make. And so they rallied, like you said, ahead of that meeting in front of City Hall, talked a lot about their experiences with homelessness or with housing insecurity and the need for, as they call it, housing justice. And so at the council meeting, kind of part of what prompted this is the council is considering an ordinance that would kind of proliferate or allow the expansion of single room occupancy housing, which is kind of, as the name suggests, typically one room dwellings with shared bathrooms, shared kitchens. And these are thought to be kind of a more affordable option for people, the working poor, people experiencing disabilities, you know, kind of people who don't have the resources maybe to have a traditional apartment.
And these could, I mean, in among other things, these could also be rented for a shorter period of time than
right.
you would traditionally rent. Is the council considering okaying these apartments? Don't they already exist?
We do have these in the city. There's about 50 right now. Back in the 80s, there used to be about 800. And so this has kind of gone out of favor, I guess, in the city in recent years. And I think part of that is because they're associated with criminality. You know, people can be very opposed to allowing kind of mixed use in their neighborhoods, things like that. But what the council would do is kind of allow these in a more zoning areas than they're currently allowed in, which could allow them to spread across the city. And, you know, they say this is a way to kind of ease the affordable housing crunch, help some people out, get them into housing that's so desperately needed in conjunction with the homelessness crisis in Salt Lake City.
From 800 single room occupancy to 50 now, that was from the 80s to today. You reported that these SROs, the single room occupancy, these kind of micro apartments, would continue to be barred from a wide range of residential areas, including neighborhoods along Salt Lake City's foothills. What's the reasoning behind preventing them from going into certain neighborhoods?
I think this is kind of a zoning issue again. But, you know, the activists that were there kind of perceive this as a not in my backyard type thing where the west side has to take on kind of more impactful uses while the east side just won't take it. You know, whether that's reality, that's kind of the perception. The Ballpark Community Council chair spoke and said, you know, we support this kind of housing, but we already have so many social services that are impactful. You know, the city as a whole needs to take on these challenges associated with affordable housing. So that was kind of the, you know, reason behind the conversation. However, many of the activists did not speak directly to the SROs, as they're called, and instead just took the time to speak to the council about their affordable housing challenges and to, I think, kind of put a face to this crisis. This has been something the city, I mean, this is not the first time the city has talked about affordable housing or has considered affordable housing. This administration has done, you know, quite a bit in terms of trying to ease this up, but it's kind of a statewide crisis. This is not just localized to Salt Lake City.
You know, you brought up that that quote from Amy Hawkins, chairwoman of the Ballpark Community Council, who said that, you know, the rest of the city has to accept their fair burden. I just want to circle back to the zoning part of this. I guess I don't really understand how these zoning conversations start and stop. But is it that other neighborhoods are saying, we don't want these? You know, is the avenues or the foothills or whatever lobbying against having these SROs near to them?
Not to my knowledge, no. I think that, as I said, I think this is kind of a zoning thing where, you know, they're not in commercial residential zones or there are certain zones where they are prohibited. But also, it does seem to be localized in these few neighborhoods. And I'm not honestly sure what the conversations at the city have been like to kind of bring that forward. Mm-hmm. It's worth noting also that this initiative has not yet passed. This was a public hearing on this issue. The council will consider this again on May 7th and make a decision there. And there's always a chance that they can make some changes and tweaks to the location and some of the particulars of these. But again, I think a lot of people say that they're in support of the SROs. However, they have concerns about some of the particulars, so the location requirements or the surveillance requirements, things like that.
Surveillance requirements. Can you just give us a little bit of what the city is considering requiring for the development of these SROs?
So someone would have to be on site kind of to monitor everything. And it sounds like the concern about some of those requirements is that they take power away from tenants, kind of in a very landlord-centric kind of way where landlords have maybe more power than they might have in kind of a traditional type of housing, I suppose.
You know, I'm remembering the dispersed site conversation around homeless shelters. And I'm wondering, you know, if these are, just going back to the what neighborhood they might appear in, if these are a burden of some sort, and I'm not saying that they necessarily are, but if they are perceived that way, wouldn't spreading that burden around make sense? And this is probably a question for George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, as opposed to the reporter's voice. George, sharing the burden or sharing the responsibility of affordable housing in the city?
Well, I think it's a legitimate point that they say, well, this is something that we ought to have. This is something that homeless people, near homeless people need. Let's put them all on the west side or in a certain area where nobody has an expensive house. So the people who live in the avenues and the foothills will be spared this burden. I don't know that that's really the point of where the city's going. I see the concern. It also, I think, makes more sense to, at least initially, locate these SROs in places where there is transit, where there is some space that could be redeveloped, like North Temple and State Street. The city owns some property, has bought some property. You have some of these old hotels that they're looking to tear down and rebuild or refurbish into transitional housing or housing for single people who are kind of down on their luck and might be able to afford something like this, whereas they could never afford first and last month's rent in these behemoths that we're building up and down 400 South now. I mean, we're building tons and tons of apartments, but none of them are affordable.
George, do you have a sense of what happened? No, sorry, I'm just thinking about the from 1980s to today, 800 to 50 single room occupancy units. Is that correct, Taylor? Units as opposed to locations or buildings. When we say 800 to 50, George, do you have a sense of what happened?
Well, the market got away from that. They tore those down. They built office buildings. They built apartments that cost $1,000-$1,200 a month. You know, with amenities and weight rooms and slate countertops and convection ovens and all this stuff for people who could afford to buy a house someplace, but they don't want to. They don't want to be stuck in a place. They're afraid of another housing downturn or something, and they're happy to live in apartments, and they can afford them.
To answer your question, it is units.
Okay, it's units from 800 to 50.
And so they tore those down, and there are only a few of them left. Nobody wanted to build another one because zoning was a problem, and there's not that much money in it.
Okay. And Taylor, you said that a decision will be made, at least there'll be more consideration given in May at May 8th, is that right?
May 7th, May the 7th. City Council meeting, 7 p.m.
Okay. It is time for another break in the show. There's still more ahead, including Moab's tourism headaches. This is Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org.
And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Brian Maffley, Moab is a famous tourist destination, and for some time now, it's been getting maybe a little too much tourist love. In your reporting on this week, you describe a sort of vicious cycle where money brought in by tourism is pumped into promotions that bring in more tourists, that is then pumped into promotions that brings in more tourists all over again, and so on. Yeah. can you give us a sense of how overrun with tourists Moab has become?
Well, discover Moab. Okay, that's the motto of their marketing campaign. And I think plenty of people have discovered it. But when you last weekend, if you tried to drive into Moab, it would have taken you half an hour just to get to downtown. And the traffic there is getting horrendous. It's even though there's hotels going up all over the place, like apartment buildings on 400 South, it's still hard to find a place to stay. Finding a place to camp is getting more and more difficult in those kind of dispersed areas outside of town. Arches is notoriously challenging to get into, and then to find a place to park once you're in the park. But there's other issues for Moab as well. Just a lot of motorized vehicles, motorized recreational vehicles like UTVs, ATVs. Well, people are driving around the streets of Moab now. It's really annoying to the folks who live there. So, of course, we did this story the other day that got a lot of traffic, far more than I thought, and it was about how the state rules regarding the expenditures of transient room tax money, half of it has to be spent at least 47%, I should say, needs to be spent on promoting tourism.
That transient room tax comes from hotels, from people staying in hotels or in rooms in Moab.
Yes, okay. And I think also at Airbnbs, but for some reason they're not collecting. That's another kind of controversy in that town. They're not collecting from those folks who are renting out their homes through Airbnb. But it's an extraordinary amount of money that Grand County gets through that tax. So last year it was $5.1 million. Which made it the county with the fourth highest proceeds, right? So it's a tiny county with only 10,000 residents, yet it's generating this huge amount of money. Only Washington, Summit, and Salt Lake counties, which have huge, huge tourism bases generate more money through that tax than Grand County. So they're rolling in this money. And a big chunk of it is used for, quote unquote, mitigating the impacts of tourism. But a couple million is available to the Moab Area Travel Council to spend on their gorgeous ads. They are gorgeous. And one of them is completely wrapping track trains. And I look at that. One day I was sitting in a tracks crossing, and this train comes slowly by, and there's this beautiful image of someone climbing on a beautiful red rock face.
You wanted to go.
I wanted to go right then and there. Yeah. Just hit the road. And
so just to get to how that money is spent on promotion, and you said almost half of the $5 million has got to be spent, or more than half.
At least almost, 47%.
Yeah. On promotion, there are people in Moab who say, hey, or Grand County, who say maybe we
enough
can change
enough.
The rules a little
yeah.
bit so that we're not doing that.
Yeah. So this has become a very sore subject in Moab. And a couple years ago, a county council member named Chris Baird proposed this idea of diverting that money to economic development initiatives that would diversify Moab's economy away from tourism. And of course, it used to be a uranium town. Now it's almost entirely revolves around tourism. And Chris Baird's idea went pretty much nowhere, and he later resigned his seat on the county council. He's now the county clerk. And he was a kind of a key source on this legislative audit that got us onto this story. It was released the week before last. And the auditors, you know, were looking at how eight counties were spending their transient room tax money and concluded that, oh, they're spending it the right way, and maybe that's really the wrong way, and the legislature needs to think about changing the rules here and allow these counties to spend it in ways that aren't currently allowed under the law.
It's interesting because there is that sort of, I mean, the economy base is tourism, but at some point you kind of love the thing to death. If you keep promoting it, more and more people come in and you're not able to manage that. George Pyle, a Yogi Berra quote comes to mind, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
You're right. It's too popular. Nobody goes there anymore. Well. So, and this is the thing when you're trying to talk to people in southern Utah about, you know, what kind of economy do you have going forward? And the people who cling to the extractive economy, grazing, oil, drilling, mining, things like that, and they say, no, and you tell them, no, you don't want to do that. That's not the future. Tourism is the future. And then they point to Moab, and they say, I don't want to look like Moab.
Yeah.
And so, and I mean, I love Moab. I go down there. I mean, we my family likes to go to Santa Fe. We always stop in Moab and spend some money there. So we pay their taxes. They really ought to change the law so that the locals have more control over how to spend the money. I mean, you'd think this would be a Utah thing, local control, but now the state sets the parameters. Some of it does go for mitigation. All of it ought to go for mitigation in Grand County. They ought to be able to build parking lots and run buses and do whatever they think locally will help absorb some of this. Yeah. Plus, we ought to spread this around. But like I say, if you go to other towns in southwest, southeast Utah, and they say, oh, we're going to build a tourism economy, and they look at you like, I don't know.
Brian Maffley, Moab used to be the kind of jumping off point in, you know, seeking solitude. Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire was set right there. Is there a bigger question to consider about what these, you know, what our economic drivers are in different places? That's a huge topic to open up at the end of the show. But your thoughts on what George is saying?
Well, you know, he suggested that maybe this TRT money can be spread around. So last year it was like $60 million was raised through that hotel tax, and ironically, the counties that really could use that money, like Duchesne and Uinta County, they hardly get anything since the oil drilling slow down and started in 2014, they get $100,000 for TRT money. Well, if any counties need money to promote tourism, it's those ones, and yet they don't have the money to do it, and it's because the TRT money stays in the counties where it's generated. That's not the case in other Western states. It goes, you know, to the state, and then they can spread it around as needed. And maybe Utah ought to start thinking about that too. That said, Grand County needs all the help it can get mitigating the impacts of tourism. Their sewer system, their law enforcement, everything is just kind of overtaxed because, as this audit pointed out, for every full-time resident, permanent resident there is in Grand County, at any given time, there's on average 2.4 visitors staying overnight there. So
for every single individual.
Yeah. So in other words, you need every person who lives there needs to be taxed to the point where they can support a couple other people who happen to be in town. So you have sales tax to help offset that, but they need more than that.
Well, huge tourism growth in Grand County. I can't let this story go by without lauding my parents for being ahead of their time, too far ahead of their time, actually. They opened a theater in Moab to put on plays in 1969 or 1970, and they had to close down because the town folk couldn't keep coming to see them night after night and supporting what they were doing. There weren't enough tourists at the time.
Now it's just a totally different story.
We have reached that time in the hour where we need to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, and Brian Maffley, do you want to kick things off?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Courtney Tanner was doing these stories about what appears to be an arms race for teacher salaries among Utah school districts. So a couple days ago, the Canyon School District announced it was starting salary was going to be increased to $50,000 a year. And apparently Granite School District has followed suit, increasing its starting salary to $43,000. And change, and that indicates a need to retain skilled teachers because they're leaving the profession, and by bumping up the starting salaries, you're basically increasing the salaries of everybody. And so maybe we'll get some of our teachers to stick around.
All right, an effort to retain teachers from Brian Maffley. Taylor Stevens, are you ready with an underplayed pick?
Yep, so some reporting from my colleague Bethany Rogers, who has been covering Utah's medical marijuana law. That medical cannabis law has some caps on how many growers are going to be able to operate under the law. 10 growers, although advocates are concerned that could set the state up for some product shortages. So interesting story you can find on sltrib.com.
Product shortages. That could be terrible.
There it is. Only 10 growers being allowed in Utah for medical marijuana from Taylor Stevens there for her pick. George Pyle, you got a pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, I got a pick for not played at all story. Ben McAdams, our new congressman, was in to see us, the editorial board, the other day. And mostly we talked about impeachment and the Mueller report and everything like that. But one of the things he's getting now where he goes is like, have you met AOC? Do you know Alexandria I can't say the whole word.
Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, just AOC. She's AOC, and that's everybody knows what that means. Well, he sits next to her on the Financial Services Committee of the House of Representatives. And speaking of the marijuana thing, they were having a hearing on a bill in which he says is one of the things that Congress might actually accomplish, because both parties are for this, to allow banks to handle money from legal marijuana operations in states where it's legal. Right now, banks won't touch the money because at the federal level, marijuana is illegal. So AOC says to Ben McAdams, you're not going to be for this, are you? And he says, oh, yeah. And she says, Utah's not for this. He says, oh, yeah. So we've legalized medical marijuana. We've got this whole process rolling out. And there's the Utah state treasurer right there here to testify in favor of this bill. And she says, you don't say. You know, I learn something every day.
All right. Interesting pick from George Pyle about Utah's being Utah's unexpected reputation, I guess.
Right.
I'm going to go with the fact that minorities are going to generate half of Utah's population growth over the next 50 years. This is according to some research done by the Ken C. Gardner Policy Institute, reported by Lee Davidson in the Salt Lake Tribune. Check that out at sltrib.com. George Pyle, Taylor Stevens, and Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger. Yeah.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and Sarah Sadie Khan here at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Please join us again next week.